My name is Rusty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not an outside controversial issue, you know. I'm a real one. And, you know, I don't have to convince you of that, you know. I just have to not forget myself. So I spent a lot of years trying to convince you that I wasn't. And now I figure it's a waste of time trying to convince you that I am. So my sobriety date is March the 12th of 1992. And I'm totally grateful for that date. That particular date is the day after I drank, of course. I was drunk. I had a moment of clarity in the middle of a drunk, which I shouldn't have had, but I did. And that moment of clarity, I came to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic and realized at that point that I was going to chase this illusion to the gates. I was already to the gates of insanity. I didn't have to go any further, walk through those, you know. But I knew that persistence would take me to death. And so I accepted that fact that day. But I got to tell you, you know, that moment of clarity wasn't one of those boomers where I just changed all of a sudden. It was one of those where I had to think for a minute to see if I couldn't come up with another good idea or another plan that would work. I had already had several DUIs, been to jail several times. The divorce was pending. The job had gone south. The two businesses had gone down the road. Several cars died from alcoholism along the way. You know, it was incredible. The evidence was piling up, and yet in my mind, this was my opinion, and I'd had it for a long time. How could a skinny redheaded, that's changed, Swedish Mormon farm kid from northern Utah be an alcoholic? There's no way that can happen. And that was the opinion that I had formed way, way back, and I kept that opinion going, you know, that there's no way I could be. You know, it's said in this program that we identify alcoholics by the ones we know. You know, and I knew one alcoholic when I was growing up, and I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I knew he was a town drunk, or the town clown, both. And guess what? He was related to me. You know, he was like a third cousin, but he was a drunk, and he was laughed at a lot, and a lot of people shook their heads at him. And that was way back in the days when, you know, you couldn't identify alcoholics by saying, oh, he's an alcoholic, you know. He's real nervous. That's the way they'd identify it, you know. He has a bad case of the nerves, you know. And so that was alcoholics when I was growing up. You know, so my identification of alcoholics wasn't too clear. But grew up in a really good family, a real good family. Hard-working, honest people. My dad was probably the most honest person I've ever known. And that holds true to today. You know, he gambled quite a bit, but we knew exactly where he was and exactly what it was he was doing. He didn't hide it. He was honest. And my mother was a person that was very concerned about what people said and what people thought. because she had grown up in a home that I found out later, after I'd gotten sober and had an honest conversation with my mother, one of the first ones in 50 years, but I found out that she had grown up in a home that had a lot of physical abuse in it, and it was the head of the household, my grandfather, and the abuse was directed at the women of the house, and she had grown up in that. It was physical abuse, and it wasn't talked about. It was done behind closed doors, and nobody said anything about it. I had no idea myself until I was sober and was talking to my mother, and she explained some of that to me. Also, at that point, when I was having one of those honest conversations with my mother, this is after March the 12th of 1992, I had told her that I had heard that alcoholism was probably genetic, and it was passed down through generations, and she was doing some genealogy work, which is, any of you that know about that in the LDS church, it's ancestry, it's the family tree, and it's going back and finding out, you know. And she had been doing quite a bit of that for a while, and so I got interested because I had heard it was genetic, and I wanted to pin my alcoholism on somebody. So I asked her, I said, well, you're doing all this genealogy work, you must have found an alcoholic back in the family somewhere, you know, please. And she thought for a minute and looked at me and said, no, as far as I know, you're the only one. And so Mom blew my cover, you know, again, and took away the one excuse that I thought that I could use, even after I'd been sober a while. But you know, in growing up, I had that typical kind of alcoholic opinion of ourselves, of myself, and that I was somehow different. And in fact, I had an illness that kind of separated me from the rest of the kids. It was fairly serious, and it stopped me from doing some things. I wasn't allowed to do much physical activity, and all of that. It left me with a heart murmur, and so a lot of sports and that were out, and a lot of work on the farm was out, and that caused me some problems, because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to play sports, I wanted to work alongside my dad, I wanted to do the things that boys are supposed to do on a farm, you know, because I was surrounded by hardworking farmers, and so that, you know, I had that kind of opinion that I wasn't, you know, too worthy. But what happened is I started to pretend a lot. I don't know. When you get in this program, we call it lying. But I was pretending a lot, you know, and I started to live that double life that we talk about, and it carried on into high school, the one thing that one of the blessings that I had in growing up, I was given a pretty good singing voice, and I sang a lot of solo, did a lot of solo work in churches and weddings and funerals and parties and you know, and all of that stuff in growing up, and that was the one place where I was a little special, you know, and that helped me kind of go on. And so I got interested in that. I love to do it. I like to do it, you know. So, you know, being up here on a stage, other than that big high step you have to step up to get up here, I told John they need to fix that for older guys. But anyway, I guess there's steps over there somewhere. Yeah, that's typical the way we handle the steps. They're over there. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Some of these we bought. Yeah. But Anyway, I sang a lot of places, and I liked it. It was fun. It was plus I was in the spotlight. You know, hell, what's not fun about that? So I was doing a lot of that, but secretly I didn't want to do a lot of that. I wanted to be back in the dark alleys, you know, and with those. So when I got in high school, I did both, you know. In the daytime, I was a good kid, and at night, I hung out with the owls, you know, at night. And so I lived that double kind of life for a long time. And the first time I got drunk, I was 14 years old, and I was on a train going to Kansas City. And they opened a club car on the train for a bunch of 14-year-olds. How convenient. And we got drunk all the way to Kansas City. That's what we did, you know, and 14 years old. And not much of, most of us hadn't had much exposure to alcohol because we were all a bunch of farm kids because we were going to a convention of Future Farmers of America. So that was it, you know. You know, I did something on that trip that was to kind of set the stage for a lot of the same kind of behavior for a lot of years after. I was supposed to audition to sing a solo there at that national convention, and I'd been practicing it for 3 months solid, you know, real hard, so that I could audition for that. And I got back in Kansas City, and I got drunk and didn't go to the audition. And that's after 3 months of working really hard and wanting to do it. I wanted to do it. But when there's drinking to be done, you know what takes the precedent for an alcoholic, even at that young age, and I didn't know that that's what would happen. That happened over and over and over again throughout my life, you know, especially my drinking life. You know, I would get drunk and not show up. I would not show up and get drunk, you know. It was just chaos. I learned after I'd gotten sober a while and started to look back at it, I learned that I'd been under the influence of alcoholism all the time. Drinking or not, it didn't matter. Sober in between drunks, I was under the influence of alcoholism. I would make bad choices and bad decisions and wrong moves and form opinions and you know, no wonder they say let go of old ideas when we come in here. you know, we got some old ideas. All my ideas are old now, but we have to change that some way, and thank God we've got a program that will do that for us. So that I don't spend a whole lot of the time talking about my drunk log, I don't have to convince you that I am. You know, I've already said that. I just have to do the things that have to be done so that I don't forget. Because I did that once. I got sober in 1987 at the suggestion of a judge and a mental health counselor who took me to my first AA meeting. I heard a couple of guys talk about Bountiful, and it was in Bountiful. They took me to an AA meeting in Bountiful, and it was a small little meeting and a bunch of older people there, they failed. They didn't keep me sober for more than a year and a half. You know, I actually went to 6 meetings and got cured. About killed me. Getting cured. I don't recommend getting cured, by the way. You know, not a good idea for us. If you're a real alcoholic, getting cured is not, that's not a good idea at all. That's painful. So I, due to circumstances and so forth, I stayed sober for a year and a half, you know, because of the threat, you know, well, the threats, you know, you know how we get all those threats, from the wives, the husbands, the friends, the family, the judges, the lawyers, you know. Oh, all of them, you know, they've all got opinions for us. And the biggest problem is that after a while we realize they're right, you know. And the jig is up, you know, we just can't do it anymore. And the one thing that happened for me in that year and a half, I worked on a project out on the desert. That's pretty good, you know, if you want to stay sober, go work out on the desert. And I worked a construction job out there, and I got healthy, you know, and I was working hard. I was up early and driving out to 80 miles one way, and spent all day long out on an ATV, out running around on the desert. You know, I mean, it was a lot of fun, for one thing. You know, and especially if you're crazy alcoholic, you can really have fun with that. You know, I was chasing coyotes all over the place, and you know, having a lunch out there, and I did that for a year on that job, and I got, like I said, I got healthy. That job ended, and I came back to started another job, and actually got within a short time was a partner in a company, it started going, you know, doing really well. It was one that would almost been failing, and it was a bowling center is what it was. And I went in and had a partner in there, and we took it over and started to you know, improve it and grow it, you know, and grow, and it was going really good. I was sober, and then it kind of leveled off, and it wasn't going up anymore, you know, and it kind of leveled off and got kind of stagnant a little bit. And in a short period of time, all this had happened, and then we started to have some problems with it, you know. Well, I didn't have any way to deal with problems. You know, I'd been to AA, but I hadn't adopted the 12 steps, and I hadn't worked them, and I hadn't continued going. And so when the problems got more than I knew what to deal with, I had my wife, I was still married at the time. This is incredible. Incredible. So I don't know how we pick women like this, or how the women pick guys, you know, that stay with us. You know, they just won't leave. I don't know what, you know, God, you know, what is it? You know, they have every reason in the world to get the hell out of Dodge, you know, when we're causing the wreckage that we're causing, but they hang in there, you know. And I was still with the same woman that I'd married, when we did divorce, we'd been married 31 years, you know. So that's a long term investment, you know. Three children by that time, I was sober that little year and a half, and my wife's uncle had come to visit the family from Colorado. And when they went back to Colorado, he had left one of those cases that holds 2/5 in it. One of them leather cases, a nice leather thing, you know. And is that the drug dealer calling back? No. Oh. No. Anyway, hope not. But they'd left that when they went back, and naturally, being really smart, I put it in my bedroom and sat it there, you know. And so for a month, those bottles started talking to me every morning. I'd get up, I'd wake up, I'd roll out of bed, and that's the first thing I saw. And I knew I was in that case, and that little chatter started, you know. One. You can have just one. Just one won't hurt, you know. Nobody will know. You know, you've been sober a year and a half. You know, you're all better. You're cured. And so one morning I woke up and I was going to bowl in a tournament. And I thought the one of those good ideas came roaring from the past and said, you know, you ought to have a drink or two to relax and you know, just one or two to get relaxed and go bowl, you know. So I had two, and I went and bowled, you know, and it was great, you know. So again, you know, the next morning, I think maybe I'll have another one to relax, you know. You know, well, I stayed relaxed for 3 years. Long story short, you know. Within about 10 days, I was drinking more than I had when I had quit a year and a half before, and I was in trouble with it then. Now I was back there doing it over again, and over and over and over. And it got bad fast. And then I started losing things faster than I could, were gaining them, you know. People started leaving, you know. And the business started to fail, and I basically was barely caring, you know, at that point. In those 3 years were the darkest 3 years of my life, no question about it. I tried to stop drinking again and couldn't, and I tried a lot of different ways, and I never tried just natural wines, you know. That we read that in chapter 3, you know. I thought, damn, you know, if I'd have tried just natural wines, I'm, that's how I think. I don't know about you guys, but you know, unless Mad Dog 2020 is a natural wine, I don't think Everclear is in that class either, you know. But I got thinking about it, but you know, I got on the wrong subject there. My thought is going there, you know. You know, and you know, some of that never goes away. By the way, it just doesn't come around often. We don't act on it. Hopefully, at least I don't. And what happened in that 3 years, like I said, was the darkest days of my life. I couldn't drink the sick away anymore. Every day was the same. It was just gray, and it was painful, and there was just nothing happening. It would just go on and on and on, and I could just see that's where it was going. It was just on and on and on, and there was no end to it, you know. I was desperately trying to grab hold of something that would stop it, you know. I couldn't. I went on, you know, trying to work, trying to pretend, trying to do whatever it was, and I was just getting more tired and more tired. The final drunk. By this time, also, I wanted to mention that I had given up everything that I'd like to do. Everything. I didn't sing anymore. I didn't play golf anymore. I'd pawned my golf clubs anyway. I didn't hunt. I didn't fish. I didn't do any of that anymore. The only thing that I was doing as far as any activity was drinking. And that's the only thing I knew how to do, and and that was it. So my last one was right before my last one, I came up with another one of those brilliant ideas that we come up with, creative ideas. This time, I don't know how I did it, but I passed the insurance exam, and during this time, and I was selling safe driver's insurance. What? Door to door. And I made a slight error in judgment during that time, and I was, I had a half a fifth of vodka in me, decided to try to sell some safe driver's insurance to an off-duty deputy sheriff. Out in West Jordan, and I became number one on his hit parade. he was thrilled to see me. As soon as I left his place, I was surrounded. Go to jail, go directly to jail, do not pass go, that kind of thing. That one, I had a nephew that was an attorney, and he got me off pretty fairly easy on that one. It was a healthy fine, and no jail time. Incredible. I don't know how that happened, but because that was my third DUI, and two of them were pretty close together. He got some community service and a pretty healthy fine, And that was a done deal, and we went to court on a Monday on that one, and cleared that up. I didn't pay the fine, but it was it was all known what needed to be done and so forth, and that was on a Monday. And on Wednesday I was drunk in Wendover, and I was driving a car that was dying from alcoholism. Every one of my cars did. This one was. I was out there at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I had forged some checks, and I had bought, a liter, and I'd got fired from my job that morning. So I wasn't able to sell safe driver's insurance anymore. And I'd driven to Wendover, where I knew people understood. So I'm sitting at a blackjack table in Wendover, and it's by this time it's about 1 in the afternoon, and I was I was where we go, I had gotten there, and all of a sudden, in the middle of that, is when I had that moment of clarity that I talked about, and I accepted the fact I was an alcoholic. I knew it was over, but I still tried to come up with another good idea or another plan. I did, and I was done. And the important thing is I knew I was done. There wasn't any question marks left, At that point, I'd been to some AA meetings. I had been going to a DUI education class before I was even sentenced to go there. That's nuts. Where did I get that idea? I don't know. I'm going to go find out how to drive drunk or something. I don't know what it was, but I was going to this DUI education class, and I got to like the guys that were running it, and they kind of liked me. They didn't like me showing up drunk, but we were having a good time, and so that I'd been doing that. I'd been going to one AA meeting a week, and I'd been doing that for 4 months, and I was drinking every day. Now, if you want to have a really good time, drink every day and go to AA meetings at night. Boy, that is the height of fun. This little meeting that I was going to was a great little group, and they were just, there was a bunch of people there that were sober quite a long time. It was in the church downtown. It was called the Downtown Bunch. Anyway, I started going there, and I was going there once a week and drinking every day. And after about a month and a half or 2 months of that, this one of the little ladies came up to me after that meeting, and she says, "You know, it might work better for you if you don't drink." And I went, "Oh, how did you know?" You know. The last meeting I went to, that I tried to chair it. Volunteered, you know. Volunteered. Yeah, pick me. And you know, that was a kind little group. You know, they were good members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They allowed drinking drunks in there. Wow, you know, I've been to meetings since then in the past few years where somebody comes in half drunk and somebody takes offense at that. How, we can't let a drunk in here. Look around. You know, but the day that we don't let a drunk in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the day when the traditions aren't working very well, as far as I'm concerned. As long as we're not disruptive, you know, and if we can drink and be nice. Not many of us can do that, but anyway. So anyway, I'm out there, and I had that moment of clarity in that meeting, and that was 2 days after I'd settled a DUI. And so a moment of clarity, I was done. You know, got to get to Salt Lake, get help. I knew who to call. I'd call the guys in the DUI education class when I got back to town, and they could help me. Well, I got to halfway. I got to Eagle Range, Dell. Pulled off of the freeway, car that was dying from alcoholism, remember. And a messenger from God pulled up behind me in a highway patrol car. And came walking up to the car, and I got out of the car, which you're not supposed to do, you know, and he's... I got out of the car, and he says, and I remember this. I shouldn't remember anything, but I remember this one. He says, "What's the problem, sir?" You know, and I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And I'm too drunk to drive, and besides, I'm on a suspended license, you know. And if you ever seen a funny look on a highway patrol's face, yeah, he had that look. Okay, we're going to jail again. Yeah, we did. And that was the last time I went to, it wasn't the last time I went to jail, because the judge decided I need to spend a little time out there later on. He put me in for 10 days, you know, which in and of itself is another miracle. But that was the point right there. I called the guys that I'd been hanging out with in this DUI education class, and he told me to come on down. You know, he says, "Come on down, let's talk." And he took 2 days off of his work and spent with me and 12-stepped me. He told me his story, you know. And I don't know how the hell he survived. You know, he had a story, but he told me one thing that was the thing that changed my whole pattern after that. And he told me to turn myself into Fellowship Hall and find out how those people are staying sober. Because he told me the truth. He says, "You don't know how. He says, I've seen you now for about 5 months. You've been hanging around and coming to our classes. God only knows why. You're going to be sentenced to him now. Yeah. Again. But he says, you don't know how, so go find out how those people are doing it. And the next day I was at Fellowship Hall. And I spent the next 3 months almost every day at Fellowship Hall. And in between, you know, some other places, I kept going to this little downtown bunch meeting. And I go to every meeting at Fellowship Hall. And I started to meet old-timers there. And the old-timers, believe me, they saved my life. They saved my life. They were willing to take the time and sit and have coffee and smoke cigarettes and tell me the truth and ask me how they could help, you know. And at that period of time, UTA was my higher power. You know, I didn't have transportation. Oh, by the way, I left that car in impound in Tooele. That's, yeah. That damn car didn't know how to do it right, so I got even with that one. But I didn't have a license to drive one anyway, so why tempt me? Because, you know, you give me a car and a non-license, it don't matter. I got the car, right? Cars are supposed to be driven, so that would be my thinking. And so, you know, UTA became my mode of transportation, and I found out real quick that it didn't want to run on my schedule, and so I started. I had to start planning my time and where I was going and all of that stuff, you know. And it was a blessing. It was a real blessing because I started to become aware. I started to wake up a little bit from that. Distorted world of alcoholism, it says in the book, and I started to wake up from that, and I started to see things, and those things had been around for a long, long time, but I started to see them now, and it kind of surprised me. I'd be riding the bus and I'd see something that looked interesting, you know. I said, oh my God, look at that. How long's that been there? And so he said, oh, about 15 years. Oh, that's funny. I thought it was new. But the awareness that comes from sobriety is terrific. It's just something that is not to be missed, you know, for anybody that's wondering what benefits you can get from being sober. Awareness is a big one. Freedom is probably... at least as big, if not bigger. The promises, the nine-step promises say we will know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, and they came pretty quickly for me. They really did. I didn't have to work all the way into the ninth step in order for those to start happening. You know, and that freedom and happiness, newfound freedom and happiness. Started to show up in my life. I hooked back up with that mental health counselor that had helped me the first time when I was sober in 87, and this is in 92, remember, and got a little cold, I'm trying to catch, I called her again, and she said, "Look, come on out, let's have a visit." This was right before I was to go in front of the judge, and I went out to see her, and the divorce was pending. I was going to see the judge, I could have been going to for a year. That was very likely at that point. I'd lost the business, didn't have a job, no driver's license, all of that stuff, you know, broke, you know, disgusted and couldn't be trusted. and she said, come on out and let's have a visit. And so I went out and had visited with her. She had taken me to my first AA meeting, and no wonder, she was 13 years sober in the program, and being a mental health counselor also. So I told her my plan, that I was going to end up going to jail, and so that'd be a great opportunity to quit smoking. And she said, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You're not drinking. You're hating it. You're getting divorced. You're not working. You're broke. You don't have any cars. You know, everybody's leaving you and all this, and you're going to quit smoking? Yeah. Yeah. She said, oh, yeah. No. No. So that was the way I made plans, you know. You know, if things are bad, I can do one more thing to make them worse. That's the way I'd always done things. But I went to jail, and you know, and it was only for 10 days. And the reason that it was only 10 days is that judge had been approached by those people that 12-stepped me earlier. And they had a little group together, and they were talking to judges and people in the justice system, trying to get them to start considering treatment for alcoholics rather than jail time and fines and suspension of license, all of that stuff. You know, they were approaching judges in person and asking them to start considering the fact that they had an alcoholic in front of them, and maybe treatment would be better. And this was, like I said, this is almost 20 years ago. And so I think the work that they did, I think today is showing some fruits of their labor, because we have drug courts and we have judges are sentencing people to treatment and to Alcoholics Anonymous, and to, you know, we're still getting those healthy fines and all that. No, you know, that didn't all go away. But, you know, but still, at least they're not trying to throw us away and bury us forever. So I started to hang out at Fellowship Hall, and I'll never forget one of the old-timers. I wish I could remember who it was. I met so many of them. And you know, and this program has just got a whole bunch of unforgettable characters running around. We've lost a lot of them over the years. You know, they've passed on, but boy, there were some great ones. You know, and they all had nicknames, and Double Down just recently, and Honest John and Hippie John and Railroad Bill, and you know, all I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But one of those old-timers, I was sitting at Fellowship Hall, and I was sitting there drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes with him, and I was telling him my sad story about how bad everything was, you know. And he just looked at me, and he says, "You think you've hit bottom?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, man, I've hit bottom. You know, I've hit the bottom of all bottoms, you know. It's hard for me." You know, and he says, "Well, wait till you drink again." And at the moment, I didn't catch it, you know. But a little later on, I did. I thought what he was trying to tell me is, you know what? It can be worse if you drink, you know. And it was bad. It was bad. But that got my attention. I'm about out of time here, That's good for you guys. You know, I got involved and I got active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the fellowship, and I've stayed involved and active in the program. I got a sponsor, was assigned to me. I was too arrogant and proud to pick a sponsor, and so that dragon lady, who was my mental health counselor, assigned me a sponsor, you know, and he started working with me and took me through the steps, you know, he did things for me that you know, I just didn't think that I could, that I would do, you know. And he never really ordered me to do anything. He always says, here's what I did, and it worked for me. Why don't you try this and see if it'll work for you? You know, and that was the approach that he took, and I needed that, and we worked together on that. And the one thing that he did have me do is for the first while is call him every day, every morning, and he would tell me to read page 311, 312 in the big book, and that's the old third edition. You know, that's the one I grew up with, the third edition, and now the fourth edition page numbers kind of throw me, but it's 275 now. And that's in the Keys of the Kingdom, and it says that this is a plan of recovery that's not over and done with. You know, he recognized that he had a hit and run artist here, and I would be looking for a drive-in window, and I would get in and get out real quick. You know, I'd grab a little sobriety and be gone, and so he did the things that kept me around and interested, and got me active and involved in the program. And I'll end with it's almost 9 o'clock, so I'm going to end with the one thing that I try to practice on a daily basis now, and I have for a long time because I heard it when it was when I was reading it in a big book study, and I've tried to adopt it as my practice now. And on page 14 in Bill's story, it says, if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life through self-sacrifice and work with others, he will not be able to meet those low spots that are sure to come. And if he's unable to meet those, he will surely drink again. You know? So to me, the key of this thing is, and it's a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun. You know, the key is self-sacrifice and work with others, you know. And, you know, God bless you all. Thank you for bringing your sobriety here tonight. Without your sobriety, I wouldn't have mine. Thank you.